Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann. This is being recorded on Sunday, March 24th, 2024. And I'm going to complete an article I started last time, What Deathbed Visions Teach Us About Living. Researchers are documenting a phenomenon that seems to help the dying as well as those they leave behind. Then I'll read a letter of recommendation. I was lonely in New York City. This tech trick helped me belong. And then I'll look how much time I have left and read various other stories. Kerr, Banas, and their colleagues based their study on daily interviews with patients in the 22-bed inpatient unit at the hospice campus in the hope of capturing the frequency and varied subject matter of their visions. Patients were screened to ensure that they were lucid, not in a confused or delirious state. The research published in 2014 in the Journal of Palliative Medicine found that visions are far more common and frequent than other researchers had found, with an astonishing 88% of patients reporting at least one vision. Later studies in Japan, India, Sweden, and Australia confirm that visions are common. The percentages range from about 20 to 80%, though a majority of these studies rely on interviews with caregivers and not patients. In the last 10 years, Kerr has hired a permanent research team who expanded the studies to include interviews with patients receiving hospice care at home and with their families, deepening the researchers' understanding of the variety and profundity of these visions. They can occur while patients are asleep or fully conscious. Dead family members figure most prominently, and by contrast, visions involving religious themes are exceedingly rare. Patients often relive seminal moments from their lives, including joyful experiences of falling in love and painful ones of rejection. Some dream of the unresolved tasks of daily life, like paying bills or raising children. Visions also entail past or imagined journeys, whether long car trips or short walks to school. Regardless of the subject matter, the visions, patients say, feel real and entirely unique compared with anything else they've ever experienced. They can begin days, even weeks before death. Most significant is people near the end of their lives, the frequency of visions increases, further centering on deceased people or pets. It's these final visions that provide patients and their loved ones with profound meaning and solace. Kerr's latest research is focused on the emotional transformation he has often observed in patients who experience such visions. The first in this series of studies, published in 2019, measured psychological and spiritual growth among two groups of hospice patients, those who had visions and a control group of those who didn't. Patients rated their agreement with statements including, "I changed my priorities about what is important in life," or "I have a better understanding of spiritual matters." Those who experienced end-of-life visions agreed more strongly with those statements, suggesting that the vision sparked inner change even at the end of life. "It's the most remarkable of our studies," Kerr told me. "It highlights the paradox of dying, that while there's physical deterioration, they are growing and finding meaning. It highlights what patients are telling us, that they're being put back together." In the many conversations Kerr and I have had over the past year, the contradiction between medicine's demand for evidence and the ineffable quality of his patients' experiences came up repeatedly. He was first struck by this tension about a year before the publication of his first study, during a visit with a World War II veteran named John, who was tormented throughout his life by nightmares that took him back to the beaches of Normandy on D-Day. John had been part of a rescue mission to bring wounded soldiers to England by ship and leave those too far gone to die. The nightmares continued through his dying days until he dreamed of being discharged from the army. In a second dream, a fallen soldier appeared to John to tell him that his comrades would soon come to get him. The nightmares ended after that. Kerr has been nagged ever since by the inadequacy of science and of language to fully capture the mysteries of the mind. We were so caught up in trying to quantify and give structure to something so deeply spiritual. And really, we were just bystanders, witnesses to this, he says. Feels a little small to be filling in forms when you're looking at a 90-something-year-old veteran who's back in time 70 years having an experience you can't even understand. When Kerr talks about his research at conferences, nurses tend to nod their heads in approval. Doctors roll their eyes in disbelief. He finds that skeptics often understand the research best when they watch taped interviews with patients. What's striking about this footage, which dates back to Kerr's early work in 2008, is not so much the content of the visions, but rather the patient's demeanor. There's an absence of fear, Kerr says. A teenage girl's face lights up as she describes a dream in which she and her deceased aunt were in a castle playing with Barbie dolls. A man dying of cancer talks about his wife, who died several years earlier, and who comes to him in his dreams, always in blue. She waves, she smiles, that's it. But in the moment, he seems to be transported to another time or place. Kerr has often observed that in the very end, dying people lose interest in the activities that preoccupied them in life and turn towards those they love. As to why, Kerr can only speculate. In his 2020 book, Death is But a Dream, he concludes that the love his patients find in dying often brings them to a place that some call enlightenment and others call God. Time seems to vanish, he told me. The people who loved you well, secured you, and contributed to who you are still accessible at a spiritual and psychological level. That was the case with Conor O'Neill, who died at the age of 10 in 2022, and whose parents Kerr and I visited in their home. They told us that just 2 days before his death, their son called out the name of a family friend who, without the boy's knowledge, had just died. Do you know where you are? Connor's mother asked. Heaven, the boy replied. Connor had barely spoken in days or moved without help, but in that moment, he sat up under his own strength and threw his arms around her neck. Mommy, I love you, he said. Kerr's research finds that such moments, which transcend the often painful physical decline in the last days of life, help parents like the O'Neills and other relatives grieve even unfathomable loss. I don't know where I would be without that closure or that gift that was given to us, Connor's father told us. It's hard enough with it. As Kerr explains, it's the difference between being wounded and soothed. In June, I visited the adult daughter of a patient who died at home just days earlier. We sat in her mother's living room, looking out on the patio and bird feeders that had given the mother so much joy. 3 days before her mother's death, the daughter was straightening up the room when her mother began to speak more lucidly than she had in days. The daughter crawled into her mother's bed, held her hand, and listened. Her mother first spoke to the daughter's father, whom she could see in the far corner of the room, handsome as ever. She then started speaking with her second husband, visible only to her, yet real enough for the daughter to ask whether he was smoking his pipe. "Can't you smell it?" her mother replied. Even in the retelling, the moment felt sacred. "I will never, ever forget it," the daughter told me. It was so beautiful. I also met with one of Banas's patients, Peggy Halosky, who had enrolled in hospice for home care services just days earlier, after doctors at the cancer hospital in Buffalo found blood clots throughout her body, a sign that the year-long treatment had stopped working. It was time for her husband, Stephen, to keep her comfortable at home with their two greyhounds. Stephen led Bannis and me to the family room where Peggy lay on the couch. Bannis knelt on the floor, checked her patient's catheter, reduced her prescriptions so there were fewer pills for her to swallow every day, and ordered a numbing cream for pain in her tailbone. She also asked about her visions. The nurse on call that weekend witnessed Peggy speaking with her dead mother. "She was standing over here," Peggy told Bannis, gesturing toward the corner of the room. "Was that the only time you saw her?" Bannis asked. "So far." "Do you think you'll be seeing her more?"
I will, considering what's going on."
Peggy sank deeper into the couch and closed her eyes, recounting another visit from the dead, this time from the first greyhound she and Steve adopted. "I'm at peace with everybody. I'm happy," she said. "It's not time yet. I know it's not time, but it's coming." "When my mother, Chloe Zerwick, was dying in 2018, I had never heard of end-of-life visions. I was acting on intuition when her caregivers started telling me about what we were then calling hallucinations. Mom was 95 and living in her Hudson Valley home under hospice care with lung disease and congestive heart failure, barely able to leave her bed. The hospice doctor prescribed an opioid for pain and put her on antipsychotic and anti-anxiety medicines to tame the so-called hallucinations he worried were preventing her from sleeping. It's possible that some of these medications caused Mom's visions, but as Kerr has explained, drug-induced hallucinations don't rule out naturally occurring visions. They can coexist. In my mother's case, I inherently understood that her imaginary life was something to honor. I knew what medicine-induced hallucinations looked and felt like. About 10 years before death, Mom fell and injured her spine. Doctors in the local hospital put her on an opioid to control the pain, which left her acting like a different person. "There were spiders crawling on the hospital wall," she said. "She mistook her roommate's bed for a train platform. Worse, she denied that I loved her or ever did. Once we took her off the medicine, the hallucinations vanished." The visions she was having at the end of her life were entirely different. They were connected to the long life she had led and brought a deep sense of comfort and delight. "You know, for the first time in my life, I have no worries," she told me. "I remember feeling a weight lift." After more than a decade of failing health, she seemed to have found a sense of peace. The day before her death, as her breathing became more labored, Mom made an announcement. "I have a new leader," she said. "Who's that?" I asked. "Mark. He's going to take me to the other side." She was speaking of my husband, alive and well back home in North Carolina. "That's great, Mom, except that I need him here with me," I replied. "Do you think he can do both?" "Oh, yes, he's very capable." That evening, Mom was struggling again to breathe. "I'm thinking of the next world," she said, "and of my husband who would lead her there." The caregiver on duty for the night and I sat at her bedside as Mom's oxygen level fell from 68 to 63 to 52 and kept dropping until she died the next morning. My mother was not a brave person in the traditional sense of the word. She was afraid of snakes, the subway platform, and any hint of pain. But she faced her death confident that a man who loves her daughter would guide her to whatever lay ahead. "Do you think it will happen to you?" she asked me at one point about her dreaming life. "Maybe it's genetic," I replied, not knowing, as I do now, that these experiences are part of what may await us all.
Phoebe Zerwick, the author of Beyond Innocence, The Life Sentence of Daryl Hunt, is a North Carolina-based journalist. She teaches journalism and writing at Wake Forest University, where she directs the journalism program. Now I'll read a letter of recommendation. I was lonely in New York City. This tech trip trick helped me belong. There is a comfort in having somewhere tried and true to go to, especially when you're a stranger in a foreign city. This is a story by Adina Glickstein. A uniquely 20-something cocktail of ambition, stupidity, and wanderlust led me to take a job in Berlin fresh out of college. My due diligence consisted of watching several of Werner Fassbinder's movies and calling it a day. I had visited the city before, crashing with lovers and loose acquaintances, but my sense of how to build a life there, or in any new place for that matter, was non-existent. The practical matters of adjusting to a new city bedeviled me. After work, I longed to navigate the city with purpose, but had nowhere in particular to go. Interminable weeks at the office gave way to lonely weekends spent not queuing up for clubs, but crying on a floor mattress in Charlottenburg, anxiety taking hold at the thought of another aimless walk. A fun decision made in haste, for all its adventurous merit, had left me lost and lonely. So I emailed a writer I looked up to who lived in Berlin in her 20s. She didn't direct me to an apartment rental agency or language school. Instead, she immediately replied with a series of Google map links, anarchist cafes and independent cinemas, Szechuan restaurants and secondhand stores. The highlight was a toilet-themed bar. I bookmarked the writer's locations in my own map and set out toward the nearest Blue Pin, a Chinese restaurant. That night, tucking into a bowl of mapo tofu, I felt something resembling solace. I sat at a table for one, but this mundane digital gesture being directed somewhere specific, walking the path of someone who had come before me, made me feel looked after. I had used Google Maps mainly for subway directions. I opened the app every day, but its social function never occurred to me. Sure, I had saved spots here and there and maintained a want-to-try list where the names of trendy restaurants piled up, never to be consulted again. The real fun, I learned, begins when you start to use Google Maps in multiplayer mode, building shared lists of saved locations with and for others, remotely populating their digital landscape little pins. It's a simple action that conjures an increasingly rare sense of virtual care. Populating a shareable map is an exercise in memory. I started making shared maps as a way of staying in touch with faraway friends and as a key to my own psychogeography, doled out to give dear ones a glimpse into my world. I've printed out QR codes with links to shared maps and given them as birthday and wedding presents. When my German bestie told me she was planning a trip to New York, I remembered my own sense of overwhelm upon walking through Manhattan after moving there at 18, as if the city were threatening to swallow me whole. I made her a Google map in hopes of making the vastness more manageable. I nudged her to my favorite haunts. Hearing her report back, I felt as if my past were intertwined with her present. The internet once promised this kind of communal reverie, evoked by the talismanic word connection. In practice, today's glut of information has rarely helped me find what I'm seeking. Searching for something like best bar in Berlin is more likely to freeze me in a state of information overload. Results are cluttered by paid placements and SEO word soup, transforming the user experience into a labyrinth of algorithm bait, making me all the more grateful for the offbeat affordances that remain. Maybe it's a stretch to say that collaboratively building a list of natural wine bars with a handful of pals counts as using the search engine against the grain. Still, something about shared mapping seems to run contrary to the spirit of contemporary tech. Reaching back to earlier eras of the internet, to spaces of play at the margins of commercialization. The joy of shared Google Maps derives from the social fabric that users create with what they're given. Shivering through a dark Berlin winter day, I complained to a friend, "All I want in this life of sin is a bubble bath." She couldn't provide me a bathtub, but she could provide a Google map called Spa Life, a crowdsourced globetrotter's guide to bodies of warm water and a few dry saunas, drawing in equal measure both from friends' actual and fantasy travels. It was annotated with helpful intel, where to find a cold plunge, where to cook an onsen egg, and inside jokes, when in bath, must bathe. Our combined commentary accumulating over time, the prospect of making the pilgrimage to many of the spots contained therein was far-fetched, but scrolling through the list lent a warmth to that drab afternoon, now filled with richly detailed daydreams about skinny dipping at a 5-star hotel in Stade. The comfort of having somewhere tried and true to go, even when you're a stranger in a foreign city, is kind of feeling one might expect the German language to contain a long compound noun for. Sadly, to the best of my knowledge, none exist. The richness of a shared map comes closest for me. It reflects the idiosyncrasy of a collective meandering, whether in actual travel or sheer imagination. How rare is it to have a big tech tool that cultivates these gestures of genuine connection? Strolling through a city, on foot or on screen, enchanted by reminders of friends' presence, feels magical. With each drop pin, a spell is cast, converting one person's nostalgia into another's newfound sense of belonging. Adina Glickstein is a Colorado-based writer and editor whose work has appeared in Art Forum, Hyperallergic, and Spike. Now I'll read another featured story, The Mad Perfumer of Parma. Hildy Soliani makes feral scents that evoke everything from oysters to opera houses. There's a picture of Hildy right next to the headline. She, under it, it says, Hildy Soliani, a perfumer and self-described madwoman. And she has black, brownish hair combed flat against her face with a curl right around her ear. Deep red lipstick. And she's looking right at the camera with very intense eyes. She looks like a foreigner to me, and from maybe Russia or the Balkans. She's got a test tube that I think she's smelling. This is a story by Molly Young. The median level of grooming in Parma, Italy, I guess she's Italian, is high. Perhaps among the highest in the world. Supporting this conjecture is the fact that the minimalist Airbnb, where I recently stayed for 6 nights, offered not one but 2 lint rollers, a blow dryer with countless attachments, a clothing steamer, and an iron. But I could find only 1 roll of toilet paper. From such minor details, it's tempting to draw conclusions about what a Parmesan considers a necessity versus what he considers merely an amenity. Parmesan is, by the way, the correct anglicized way to refer to a person from the city of Parma, which is in the Emilia-Romagna region of Italy, just below the knee of the boot. Parmesan is also, of course, the name of the province's most famous edible contribution to humanity. Other contributions include Parma ham, the film director Bernardo Bertolucci, the conductor Arturo Toscanini, and Pietro Barria of Barria Pasta, the dark blue box at your local supermarket, not to be confused with the medium blue box of Di Secco, which is from Abruzzo. Parma is a city of inventive door knockers and narrow streets that become belligerently slippery after one instant of rain, and racks upon racks of men's underwear in innovatively bizarre cuts and fabrics. More than anything, however, it's a city of aromas. Parma is not the capital of perfume, nor even geographically adjacent to it. That would be the French town of Grasse. But in keeping with the attentive grooming of the average Parmesan, there are a startling number of perfume stores lining the streets. In the city center, it's easier to buy a bottle of scent, high-end or low, than it is to buy a carton of milk. Crowding the shelves of boutiques and pharmacies are perfumes that smell like Calabrian citron, rhubarb, and violet. They're perfumes inspired by tears, slow caresses, erotic nights, the color red, the trait of extroversion. Perfumes called Arrogance and PDF, after the painter Piero della Francesca, not the Adobe file format. There are bottles with intriguing labels like Police Instinct, Police Blue Desire, and Police Daydream. There's a scent named Barry Lyndon after Stanley Kubrick's 1975 film. It features notes of leather, arnica, and fresh alpine herbs. I was in Parma to meet Hildy Soliani, who is an artista dell'olfatto e del gusto, or artist lady of smell and taste, as her website translates. She has created fantastical perfumes like Lacrima, the smell of snow, Tutti Matti per Colonna, the smell of herbs eaten by cows in Italy, and Vecchi Rossetti, the smell of a theater dressing room. But her most beloved offerings are those known among perfume enthusiasts as gourmands, perfumes that smell like food. Fragrance in general, but especially gourmands, exploded in popularity around the time of COVID. This was unrelated to the virus's frightening symptom of anosmia, though it's hard not to notice and fail to make sense of the coincidence. For one angle, the fragrance trend was inevitable. Stress sniffing was the non-caloric parallel to stress baking. Those who weren't abusing cupcakes and banana bread were trying to smell like them. They quickly discovered the work of Soliani, who has been turning out hyper-realistic gourmands for years. Buonissimo, brioche and cappuccino. Donna Senza, bananas and whipped cream. Orgasmo, amaretto. Il tempo del mele, apple cake, and many more. On the other hand, the profusion of perfume content in isolation and across social media was perplexing. Unlike baked goods, which can at least be photographed, aroma is immaterial. There's truly nothing to see. The COVID boom casually defied the entire history of perfume, in which aromatic substances have primarily been used for purposes of targeted seduction. Ensnaring a mate, general attraction, wanting other people to think you smell nice, or ritual, anointing the dead, appeasing the gods, expelling demons. Locked in their homes, people discovered en masse that perfume could also be a private aesthetic experience, a hobby, a form of entertainment. 30 years ago, a customer had to schlep to a department store to sniff tester strips while fending off salespeople from all directions. Now there are sites like FragranceNet.com and Lucky Scent and the Perfumed Court, where a customer can order samples in itty-bitty vials for itty-bitty prices, such as $3.99. Until I encountered the COVID perfumiverse and became a member myself, it never occurred to me that a person might treat fragrance as an accessory, changing it from day to day according to mood, season, or whim. I thought a fragrance was more like a soda, a careful purchase acquired after a period of deliberation and for the purpose of occupying a designated location somewhat interminably, perhaps even for decades. In Soliani, two new forms of consumer behavior found an unexpected point of convergence. Here was a woman whose line included both irresistibly strange fragrances, what is the smell of snow anyway, and the olfactory equivalent of food porn. She even devised a scent that united the two, Miss Tranchant, whose primary notes are listed as Fragrantica, the Wikipedia of perfume, as butter and oysters. Butter and oysters. Soliani's reputation among fragheads, their word, not mine, is an outsider artist, or what used to be called as such. Her packaging is unpolished, the range of her senses feral, and her website's design screams credit card fraud risk. Most important, she is unconcerned about coherence. Coherence is for brands, not artists. Luckily, fragheads gravitate toward idiosyncrasy. In Miss Tranchant, I found my fragrance. At first spray, it smells like a stick of Land O'Lakes marooned on a beach at low tide. Over 10 minutes, it mellows into a mesmerizing cloak of spicy vanilla with just a hint of sex under a pier. I've received zero compliments on it and two pieces of forceful negative feedback. Miss Tranchant is perfume as not only a personal aesthetic experience, but also apparently an indefensible one. The scent is diaphanous, nasty, transformative. I believe it to be a masterpiece. When tickets to Parma dipped below $650, I booked a trip to meet its maker. The night I arrived in Parma, Soliani, 62, suggested we meet for risotto at a white tablecloth restaurant half a block from a 16th century ducal palace. One of the first sentences she spoke was, "I am a crazy lady." Then she said, "At the end of the week, you will understand why I am so crazy." Soliani is pronounced as you would expect, and Hildi is Ildi, with the tongue doing something untranslatably sensual to the L sound. She showed up to dinner in a plain black ensemble that, at close range, turned out to be spangled with nanoscopic pink dots. What looked like attire, in other words, was actually fashion. This is a signature Soliani move, a maneuver she applies broadly and prankishly to much of her work. For instance, that fragrance that smells like apple cake costs $175. Apple cake fragrance may sound like something you could buy at Bath and Body Works, but there are, along with gauzy distinctions in branding, material differences in raw ingredients that render Soliani's version exquisite. Soliani's maternal grandmother, Marcella, was a perfume maker who sold her wares to moneyed locals in the 50s. It was from the self-taught Marcella that Soliani learned to extract garden scents through the centuries-old process of enfleurage, which involves capturing volatile flower essences by delicately layering blossoms in a fatty medium. Enfleurage is depicted in books and art as intensely erotic. Soliani's description was more blunt. It's easy. You put petals in pig grease, and then you wait. under parental pressure, Soleani, who dreamed of being an artist, attended business school and then worked as a marketing consultant. The pressure didn't stick. At 40, I said ciao to everybody and started to make perfume. When the food arrived, Soleani had ordered for both of us the same dish of nettle risotto. It was fragrant and pond green. Tell me what you smell, Soleani commanded. Salt, cheesy, chicken? No, she said, this is pork. Think of the nettle, I added. Grass? The grass taste is from the butter. In Italian, we don't say buon appetito because it's not so elegant. It's rude. She spooned a bite of risotto. You like it? Soleani is quietly dominant. She doesn't speak in torrents, doesn't interrupt, but she is decisive, uncompromising. She remains still when conversing except for her El Greco hands, which palpate and prod the air, and her head, which undulates and swivels. When moving through a crowd of darting and preening Italians, her presence is anomalous, a sea anemone amid parrotfish. She appreciates people with assertive taste, a cultivated palate, and a touch of insanity. In describing a person she admires, Soleani will say, he is completely out of his mind, or she's a mad woman like me. Soleani works at night, from midnight onward. During the day, she sleeps, reads, does admin. The creative work happens in a messy office that she refers to as my confusion. After coming up with a concept, the smell of money, the smell of confetti, the smell of hot guy eating breakfast, she'll scribble a formula of raw ingredients down on paper, fiddling with quantities until the recipe feels workable. Then she transfers it to an Excel spreadsheet and sends it to one of two labs that she works with. The lab will mix the formula and send a sample to Soleani, who will make edits and send those back, and the two go back and forth until she's satisfied. Before approving a formula, she abstains from coffee, wine, and onions for a week. These things dirty the tongue and also the brain. When you go to a perfume shop, they give you coffee beans to clean the palate. This is stupid. To clean the palate, you have to wait. Stop sniffing. Drink water. Coffee beans are no help. Next, the formula must be checked against the latest restrictions from the International Fragrance Association, which regulates fragrance ingredients with a heavy hand and to the annoyance of seemingly all independent perfumers. If it passes muster, Soleani purchases raw ingredients, natural and synthetic, from suppliers in Switzerland, France, and Italy. The ingredients are shipped to factories in Milan and Parma in plastic or aluminum barrels, then combined and allowed to rest for at least a year before being added to an alcohol base. Every bottle is filled by hand. Soleani says that she periodically switches between factories to keep her recipes from prying eyes. Perfume is full of secrecy, some of it reasonable, perfume formulas generally aren't patented, and much of it not. Soleani was cagey about divulging the names of the masters who had taught her the craft, and about confirming or denying attempts by multinational companies to acquire certain of her fragrances. Soleani's perfume is less an equation than a painting. Anytime you want to reproduce a scent, flowery, sweet, anything, and you're using synthetics, you have to use a minimum of three ingredients in that same family, she said. This is a way in which her addition of, say, a perfume that evokes whipped cream differs from the mall version of same. If you smell like one thing, you don't smell. You stink. If you want to reproduce something exactly, you can use one ingredient. If you want to recreate an atmosphere, an emotion, a situation, you always need to use a minimum of three ingredients. Otherwise, you can't call it a fragrance. Trattoria ai due platani is 10 minutes by taxi from Parma. Instead of, for example, a towering floral arrangement, guests entering the restaurant are greeted by a Carpigiani gelato machine from 1964, roughly the size of a refrigerator. It features a vanilla chrome chassis outfitted with knobs, spigots, vents, and tempting buttons. The graceful curves of the device require caressing. When we arrive, Soliani's posse fondled and admired the gorgeous Italian machine. A few steps farther into the space brought a visitor into contact with a broad window that revealed the workings of the kitchen. A different kind of gorgeous machine, with specialists performing the skilled, repetitive motions of folding, stretching, pinching, and palpating. Beneath the kitchen window was a tiny altar to the Joker, as played by Heath Ledger and Joaquin Phoenix. Polished glass vitrines projected a Joker action figure, iPhone case, and painted portrait. One enchantment of travel is that it robs you of the ability to precisely attribute idiosyncrasy. This Joker altar, did it unearth profound cultural links to Commedia dell'arte, or was it simply the work of a restaurant manager who had seen through the thin veneer of our so-called society? Soliani had arranged for a multi-course lunch featuring three dishes related to her fragrances. These would be surrounded by a number of unrelated to perfume dishes meant to highlight foods of the region. The guests, who included a professor of physics named David Cassi and a winemaker named Vincenzo Venturelli, were seated in a wood-paneled private room. A sound system piped in American disco, then Italian disco, then American insurance commercials, and finally, soft jazz. Soliani wore a bounteous shawl that was woven or printed with the image of a second shawl, a random act of mise in abbe. Forgive my Italian. The first course arrived, a porcelain dish of gray-flecked butter whipped with lightly cooked oysters to be applied to bread or eaten straight with a provided spoon. Miss Tranchant. This dish was invented by Soliani's friend Mauro Uliassi, whose restaurant in the seaside town of Senigallia has been awarded 3 Michelin stars. Uliassi, who has expressive curly hair and wears funky glasses, made a special trip to Parma to recreate his oyster butter. When the butter landed on the table, he requested that everyone smell it before tasting. We all hinged forward at our seats. Some misjudged the distance and left a faint imprint of nose on butter. As we ate our briny circles, a bottle of Miss Tranchant was passed around the table for spraying and sniffing. The fidelity to the source material was alarming. A rose gold Trebbiano provided by Venturelli accompanied the oyster butter. A man in his late 70s, Venturelli wore gold aviator glasses with an argyle cardigan and said almost nothing throughout the meal, but commanded the respect of all. This silent commanding of respect is not a skill unique to Italian men, but it seems endemic to the population. The winemaker's eyebrows were so frequently engaged in a skeptical arch that on the rare occasions when he relaxed them, an indelible wrinkle remained in commemoration of skepticism, like the step-worn grooves of an old stone staircase. Uliassi's next dish featured 4 tubulettes of pasta wearing hats of tomato sauce and feathers of fresh basil. It looks straightforward enough, pasta, red sauce, and basil. For this, a Michelin-starred chef traveled 300 kilometers. At the arrival of the pasta, however, Uliassi and Soliani began to wriggle with a mischief that suggested things were not as they seemed. As guests tucked into their tubulettes, a murmur kicked up. The sauce tasted not of tomato flesh, but of tomato leaves. It looked red, but tasted green. An interesting surprise, Soliani said, with a queenly smoothing of her shawl. Stecca is the name of Soliani's tomato leaf scent, and a bottle of it was sent around the table. Stecca was a tart blast of stalks, leaves, and arable soil that soon grew juicy and wet, as though the wearer were a worm oozing around a vine before stumbling upon a ripe fruit. Once again, the congruence between pasta dish and fragrance was eerie. Next, two dainty pillows of tortelli, one filled with ricotta and one filled with pumpkin. They smelled of decadent childhood, sweet, milky, creamy, delicate. An argument erupted. Soliani translated the conflict. It was about which of the tortelli fillings, ricotta or pumpkin, was superior in flavor. The pitch became emotional. Someone suggested that the only way to settle the matter was for everyone to eat the tortelli again, but with heightened vigilance. A request was dispatched to the kitchen. The room went tensely silent. 10 minutes passed, and a copy of the tortelli course arrived. In the end, it was declared a draw. Wines had been poured throughout the meal, and by the sixth course, there were dozens of glasses on the table. Each wine was accompanied by an entertaining oration from Filippi Marchi, a wine expert. Well, I assumed it was entertaining based on the chortling and oohing of the guests. All of the wine exposition, most of the lunch conversations, was conducted in Italian. Occasionally, someone would remember that an American journalist was there to write about Soliani and her element, and a random phrase would be translated. Influencer di Instagram, for example. But the consensus was that if the American didn't speak Italian, then that was her problem. Which it was. But it wasn't a major problem. Between English and Spanish cognates, words from cartoons, bravo, and many requests for clarification, all patiently humored, I caught plenty. The language has also been infested by American slang. The word chill, for example, runs rampant in Parma. Later, I asked a young woman what the word signified to her, and she explained chill was like piano, piano, softly, softly, or gently, gently. The swapping of piano, piano for chill struck me as a downgrade, but also as an opportunity for cultural exchange. I made a mental note to take piano, piano for a spin when I got home. For course number 7, a server wheeled in a cart featuring a mountain of gelato churned in the Carpigiani machine that we all visited many hours earlier. The cart was laden with chocolate sauce, chocolate balls, rum balls, Zabaglione, Grand Marnier, Chartreuse, and Borsi. Venturelli requested his gelato with a splash of chartreuse. When finished, he requested a second bowl, this one topped with Grand Marnier. After emptying the second bowl, he abruptly vanished from the table and was gone 10 minutes, possibly for a rejuvenating stroll. Upon return, he asked for a third bowl of gelato, this one unembellished. The final bottle of perfume went around the table. This one, called Avatar, mimicked the experience of entering a gelateria. It was the most unnerving, evocative of the three lunch scents. At first spritz, it smelled like cold marble, polished glass, wiped surfaces. 10 minutes later, the scent was that of gelato, cream, egg yolks, white sugar. Later that evening, after lunch was over, I sniffed my left wrist and nearly shrieked. The cold marble and sugared cream had vanished. In their place was a smell that didn't exist earlier, that seemed to arise from nothing. It was the smell of freshly baked ice cream cones. What sorcery was this? Not any kind of sorcery, actually. It was, if you're a chemist, smells are made of molecules which come in different sizes and weights and levels of complexity. Some odor molecules are detectable by humans, but in order for us to smell one, it must evaporate from wherever it lives, a ripe nectarine, a gym bag, and physically enter the nose, because the smelly molecules that make up a perfume come in various shapes and weights. They escape and fly into noses at different rates. Some zoom up there instantly. Others stubbornly refuse to take wing until hours have passed. When perfumers, or the promotional materials that accompany a perfume, refer to top notes, middle notes, or heart notes, and bass notes. This is what they mean. The molecules that evaporate speediest are the first to reach your nose, as well as the first to disappear entirely. Top notes are ephemeral. If you buy a fragrance based on the top notes, you'll be forever trying to write a check that chemistry can't cash. After the coy top notes comes the sturdier middle notes, which have a slower rate of evaporation. The bass notes last longest, sometimes through several showers. If you know the rate at which each layer evaporates, you can program a fragrance like a piece of software. Near the end of the trip, I visited Soliani in Barreto, and it was where she led the way to her kitchen that a certain national cliché rendered itself undeniable, specifically, that the home kitchen to Italy, what the pub is to England or the café to France, a signature venue. The top notes of Soliani's kitchen were coffee from a mocha pot and sugar-sprinkled apple cake. The middle notes were polished wood and time-worn upholstery. Bass notes, the warm feline fur of Tiger and Mima, Simonetta's cats who darted underfoot as slices of cake were distributed. Along with the cake, the table was cluttered with bottles of perfume. So much perfume, Soliani sprayed the scents into a tissue one by one and passed them over. There was Quinn, smelled like meringue, Fragola Salata, salted strawberries, Il Tuo Tulipano, fruity floral melange, Pueso, a summer's day, and Il Tempo del Mele, the apple cake perfume that replicated what we were at that instant eating. Finally, she held up a bottle of Lacrima. Instead of using tissue for transmission, Soliani spritzed it into an empty plastic cup. Lacrima is Soliani's most gimmicky-seeming perfume, the one listed on Fragratica as having the single olfactory note of snow, which, being frozen water, is famously odorless. How could Lacrima be anything but a one-liner at worst and a koan at best, the smell of one hand clapping or something like that? In Soliani's maze of a brain, the smell of snow was neither a fanciful metaphor nor a scientific challenge, but a feasible alloy of the two. There was, she knew, an old, old ingredient, a synthetic raw material that reproduced the smell of coldness. Alongside the ingredient was a memory from childhood of going into the mountains and playing gleefully in fresh snow. This all came back to Soliani one night when she was working in her office and a storm blew in. Within 3 hours, the field beyond her window was an expanse of frozen fluff. She went outside, lay down in the snow, and began to cry. Lacra means teardrop with happiness. The next morning she woke up, retrieved a fresh sheet of paper, and started her next formula. The writer Molly Young is a contributing writer for the magazine and a book critic for the New York Times. And I'll end with Judge John Hodgman. My 60-year-old brother has never seen Star Wars. Help! His excuse? He thinks sci-fi is dumb. And the reader writes, Aaron writes, my brother Joel is 60 and I'm 52, but despite growing up in the 70s, Joel never saw the original Star Wars. Now he refuses to because sci-fi is dumb. Please order that he watch it with me on his next visit. I will even provide the gummies if needed. And the judge writes, as I settled in this column recently, Star Wars is not science fiction, but fantasy. But even if I were wrong, I'm not, he should still watch it. Joel will probably claim to hate it, since he's already sunk half a century and his whole personality apparently into being a cranky Star Wars contrarian. But secretly, he'll like it because it's a very fun movie that also happens to have completely reshaped the cultural imagination of planet Earth. But since you brought it up, a fun prank might be to double the gummies and say he's watching Star Wars, but then show him the Star Wars holiday special instead and watch his brain break. Thank you for joining us. for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.